itching powder in this movie.
Yeah. Good one.
Our old teacher used to say.
Anyway, we've been talking to Lisa Neville of Cortland University and Matthew of KBOO and Gremlin Time about the 2013 film Ida, which is well worth seeing again and thinking about and discussing in your monthly film club meeting group. Thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next week. So until then, keep watching the screens.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Community Radio.
KBOO's Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kboo.org to learn more. That's program@kboo.org.
Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And you are, and today we're going to talk about the Internet of Things, or why is my toaster smarter than I am?
Well, so I just want to say, our personal toaster is not smarter than me.
You're calling our toaster stupid.
No, although I don't understand all the buttons, I do know it doesn't communicate with anybody else.
Okay, well, this is just an indication. When we talk about the Internet of Things, that's what I'm going to geek out about here today, is this.
You're getting geek out already?
I'm trying. and this is kind of the second wave. You know, the Internet itself was in theory a way of connecting people and information with each other. And that was regardless of time and regardless of distance. And it was quite a remarkable thing. I remember when it was first available, and I would be looking at a document and going, whoa, look at this. It's in Scotland, and I can read it here on my computer. I mean, that's, you know, just amazing to me. Yep. And or you could send an email in real time, and somebody around the world at no charge could respond to you. And then you start getting videos. And
I remember being in China, and they sent me together the emails for the news feed, and I was so nervous about it. How could that possibly happen? And they were coming in from South America and the US, and it was like a miracle.
So we're just showing how old we are, but at this point
we're not yet.
Okay, so we're starting this. We created this thing where 3.5 billion people on the planet could be connected together, interconnected together. There are positives, there are negatives about that. But the Internet of Things say, okay, we're not going to just be communicating amongst people. We're going to be communicating amongst things, devices, electronic devices.
Refrigerators and air conditioners and hot water tanks.
Yeah, they talk about your refrigerator's going to know if you need to order ketchup. I think that's one of those silly, dumb things that people point to, like, I think I can figure out if I need ketchup or not without.
I don't know. Sometimes you run out
of my refrigerator. Okay. And it's not necessarily the end of the world. But there are currently about 27 billion devices connected to the internet. So we've got 3.5 billion
individual devices.
Yeah. And these are things we're talking about, things like smoke detectors. You know, if the smoke detector goes off in your home, it can now call your cell phone, it can call the fire department. You've got these Ring doorbells, you know, that have cameras. If somebody comes to your door, you can see who it is, whether you're home or not. That's kind of the beginning of the Internet of Things. We talk about those on an individual home level, where you've got thermostats that can know if you're in the home. If you are in the home, it's going to set it at some temperature. If you're not in the home, it's going to set it to another.
Mm-hmm. Some people have robots that talk to you and send out. Some people have toys that.
Well, and vacuum cleaners. What's that, Zumba or something?
So, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't even have a functioning actual vacuum cleaner, let alone
the dogs.
A robotic.
Yeah. The dogs.
Oh, it's on the floor. Come on over here.
Yeah, it's edible.
So these are the smart home ideas: thermostat control, air conditioning, heating control, lighting control, security alarms.
Gosh, that's going to take up a lot more energy too, isn't it?
Well, these are fairly low energy devices, but they add a layer of complexity, I think. And we'll get into that about some of the downsides of this. But when these things are being promoted, this is the upside. You know, you've got this way of monitoring, and it's not only you, because then it would just be a device communicating with another person. It's devices communicating with other devices.
But why would I want to do that? I mean, I don't like the way that feels.
Well, okay, let's say your smoke detector goes off. Wouldn't you like them to call the fire department? And you may not be home, but you just assume your house didn't burn down. So that's
my house won't burn down.
Well, okay, but
a different kind.
A proverbial.
All right, a proverbial.
Okay, not everybody lives in houses.
I'm just being a smart aleck.
Made out of mud. So anyway, so those are the things. But then it can go extend beyond the home. Now you can get into the Internet of Things as it refers to smart cities. So, for instance, you could have streetlights that are monitoring the traffic on the streets and synchronize themselves on an ongoing basis, so that you're not sitting at a red light all the time when nobody else is over there. They can create traffic flow.
Or maybe the lights wouldn't be on if nobody was walking or driving.
Yeah, those are ideas. Or parking spaces that let you know they are now empty. And that's a big deal in some cities. They estimate as much as 30% of the traffic in major cities are people driving around looking for a parking space.
That's true. That's true in lots of even small towns.
Sure. So if you had a parking space open up and all of a sudden it notified your phone, well, then you and 700 other people can try and rush in
race
there.
And crash into each other.
That's mine. I got it first. Or you could probably get premium service where you get notified 3 minutes before others.
Anybody else, guaranteed.
So we've got these smart city ideas that extends it beyond. You can have the smart electrical grid. That's something we've talked about a little bit in previous shows, where the whole electrical system in the United States can be determining what loads are coming up, how do we service these loads, how do we delay loads. For instance, if somebody sets their dishwasher to say, okay, run when there's energy available, don't run when there's not.
Yeah, a lot of places are doing that. Or your hot water tank, you know, they've been doing that for many years. That's a good example.
Right. And then the great next frontier, which everybody likes to talk about when they're on the in all of the trade journals, is the human body, like the Internet.
Oh, geez, never going to happen for me.
Well, not for you, but
I'm not going to do it.
But for instance, pacemakers, heart monitors, these things can send real-time data out there to your doctor. If there's a emergency, it's that kind of like, I've fallen and I can't get up kind of thing, only you don't have to press the little button and say, I've fallen and I can't get up.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm probably getting ahead of you. But my first thought is the thing that you were listening to about hackers and how they can hack. Okay, I'll wait.
Yeah, we'll talk about the downside. But right now I'm trying to show you this is the promise. This is where it's going.
Are you happy about this? I mean, this is a moral issue.
Some things, some things. Uh-huh. I mean, I like to be able to pick and choose.
Can you?
Well, to a limited extent. Again, you're getting into some of the downside because I live in an area where we're still waiting for dial-up telephones. So, you know, this Internet of Things has all these promises, but these promises rely on an underlying infrastructure.
Yeah, they're mostly for urban.
That in much of the country doesn't exist. And when you say they're mostly urban, well, in the inner city, they're not there either. So they're mostly middle-class concentrated, relatively wealthy neighborhoods. That's what they're for.
Well, we won't have to worry then.
No. those people move out when we move in, you know?
That's right.
So we have
goats.
Okay. Well, they're probably hacking. They're the ones
that the goats are hacking.
So this is some of it. So we've talked about your smart home, your smart city, your smart medical body, in theory, you know, insulin injections, you know, they have those where you have an implant.
Pump.
That pumps and monitors your blood glucose levels or whatever. I'm talking about things I don't know, but then they monitor it and adjust for it. And so this is the promise.
But what could go wrong? I mean, what if it doesn't function properly and it gives you too much or not enough? Well, not enough, you would know, but.
Well, I want to give you a couple other examples because some of these things get kind of silly before we get into the what will go wrong, because, you know, anything devised by mankind is devised to not work the way it was devised, you know.
Well, not to send us off track, but really, you know, the problem with this is that it's still based on the idea that technology will cure all.
Oh, sometimes it does.
Like, what did it cure, really?
Well, if I want to drive to California, a car is helpful.
Okay, yeah. I mean modern technology. Cars have been around for 100 years.
It's fairly modern in the global scheme
of things.
All right,
but I'm serious. I feel like this is saying, okay, we'll just put all of our cards in one basket and it will be...
Every time I give you a positive, you're going to jump in with the negative Nelly here. And there will be plenty of time for that because there are an awful lot of negatives. But... This is the big one. Location tracking. Location tracking is going to be huge.
It already is.
I know it already is, but this, I mean, you ain't seen nothing yet, Gomer.
Men track women with their phones and hurt
them. Now you're talking stalking, but I'm talking about...
What do you call it?
Well, there are a lot of legitimate reasons to track things. Like, I want to track my package.
Okay, right. Well, that already happens.
Packaging, yeah. Uh-huh. A store may want to track its inventory. Did it get misplaced on the shelf? I need to know where these things
are. The library tracks their books. Yeah, that's already happening.
Truckers, they're being dispatched, and every vehicle has a tracking device so that their boss can know that they're not sitting by the side of the road, you know, sleeping or whatever.
Lollygagging.
So there's a lot of tracking going on, an awful lot. Of course, there's when you talk about planting, the environment, you know, farmers, all of this, you can have soil monitors that are monitoring in real time how much moisture is in the soil.
They're already doing that.
They have huge tractors
that think for you so that they just hook up to another tractor, don't even need a human being in it.
Right. Well, but that's like basically there you're talking about GPS. So you're... vehicle is communicating with the GPS system,
right.
And that's part of the Internet of Things. You've got there's really, this is a real thing, garbage cans that are connected to the internet and the garbage person know when they're full.
Do they have names?
I don't know.
Like George and Harry?
Huey, Louie, and Dewey?
Wasn't
that Silent Running or something, that movie where the little robots, they all look...
No, Huey, Dewey, and Louie are the ducks.
I know, but they were named after Donald.
Oh, I
nephews.
See.
Okay, so we're three generations of references here.
I don't know that movie.
So that, now another thing which would drive you and me and everybody hopefully absolutely bonkers is targeted advertising.
But they're already doing that too.
Okay, I know I said everything that we're talking about exists, but it's just in its infancy.
Oh, that's gross, because all you have to do is look at something online and suddenly on the side of your screen, it starts promoting to you all the different companies that want to sell you something.
Yeah, usually something you've already bought.
Like I asked you the other day, have you been looking at harmonicas?
Yeah, suddenly they decided I needed rhythm in my life or something. Maybe maybe I played a Bob Dylan song or something. So, and then there's things like, so the targeting advertising. You're walking through a store and every little display goes and modifies what it shows you based on what you just looked at
or
what you were thinking about. That could be
interesting. You're going to put a chip on you that will be able to connect with. Mm-hmm. It's true. I could see it happening. I don't know if it's happening, but it just a little chip up by your brain, and then it would just be able to talk to all those little monitors and tell you exactly what to do. Or isn't that like virtual reality?
No, the virtual reality would be a whole different thing. But you are talking about, you know, how are you going to monitor? We don't necessarily need a chip embedded in our body. We've got the silly phone that people don't go anywhere without. And that's basically a little chip in their body that they don't leave home without. So anyway, at this point, I wanted to just take a break here and remind everybody that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you that it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And after this conversation, I say thank God.
Thank God. Okay, well, it is the end of the world as we know it. I mean, the way we have done things. This Internet of Things is going to change everything in ways so much more dramatic than the Internet of Internets did. You know,
Be no privacy anywhere.
Well, yeah.
It's like 1984. There's one corner in the closet.
Yeah, but in 1984, there was a corner. No, you're not going to have a corner to hide in.
It'll be all curves.
No, and of course, a lot of people will think this is great. I mean, a lot of people tell everybody every day what they had for breakfast, you know? So on Facebook, and think that that's newsworthy. So I think a lot of people will give up that privacy for the convenience that all of this. Okay, so let's get into the downside. Okay, I tried to talk about the upside of the Internet of Things, but you wouldn't let me. So now
I'm so powerful.
Now at this point, now I'm going to start agreeing with you.
Okay, that'll be the day.
Okay, now to me, the first and foremost thing that bothers me about this is absolute and total information overload. You know, I think people don't take a break, you know, to sit and actually think at all. I mean, you just notice people sitting there. Well, they don't just sit there and look at the breeze and feel the breeze, look at the birds or whatever. They're looking at their friggin' phone, you know? I mean, that's
in America. I was shocked when I was in Europe and people were sitting on the subway train and they were reading books.
Yeah. Well, that's information as well. But anyway, that's a more sedate way of getting information. But at this point, you are just inundated all the time with sensory overload.
There's a lot of studies that show that humans were never meant to have that kind of stimulation.
Sure.
And that it's detrimental and going to shorten lifespan tremendously.
Yeah, well, your brain gets tired. Your brain gets overloaded.
Well, the body gets tired of the stress of it.
Uh-huh. And I think that tends to reflect itself in people's moods, you know, in the use of drugs to cope.
Oh, their behavior in general, issues, frustration
the
levels.
The way they drive their cars when I'm around. Yeah,
anxiety.
That's a big problem.
Well, let's not talk about
how
you
drive. Yeah,
when
we talked about the Internet of Things, we never even did mention smart vehicles. I mean, when smart vehicles
get out there. Oh, that's terrifying.
I don't know. You know, I've thought about that a bit, about smart vehicles, because the way people drive, machines can't be worse.
All right, but if you have machines that are tuned into your thinking and your intellect, that machine could get mad just like you do. Like, okay, go faster. Go turn there and ram into that car. No, I don't think it's good.
I think that's a bit of a stretch, but I think there are opportunities for these machines to break down, but there are certainly opportunities for human beings to break down while they're driving. So that's less of a concern to me. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to play out. I'm kind of ambivalent to the whole self-driving vehicle thing.
Well, one thing that I'm not ambivalent about, I've thought about this a lot at different times when you bring up these things, is it feels like we're just like the telephone or the toaster. We are the product.
Right. Yeah. Well,
and we're being bought and sold.
Sure. There's a saying that if you don't pay anything for the product, then you are the product. You know,
well, we pay, but we're still the product.
A lot of these apps that people use, people download software apps on their phone, they think they're free, but you are really the product.
Yeah.
What they're doing is tracking your behaviors and selling that, tracking your information about where you are, your location. Why does your flashlight need to know where you are? You know,
it doesn't, but they need to know.
They want that information.
They want to know how many chickens you're checking on in the middle of the night.
Well, I think they're just mostly wanting to know, who knows what people are out there, who downloaded it.
The darn thing actually takes a video and you don't even know it.
Could be. I know your phone will monitor your conversations, even if if you're not using it. So these are issues, big data issues. Like there's an example of a chat room. Chat room's a bit of an old term
at this
point.
They still say that.
But where people were discussing medical issues, and basically what the company that was hosting the chat room was doing is gathering all the information about the individuals as they discussed it, and then supplying that to drug providers, insurance providers, so that if you said, I think I've got colon cancer or whatever, all of a sudden your insurance rates go up because you mentioned that.
Or you get canceled.
Yeah, or they cancel your insurance, you know. So that's certainly something you didn't think was going to happen when you unburdened yourself to your fellow, you know, people on that same interest group. So those are issues. Those are real issues. And that gets to your privacy issues. You know, there is no such thing as privacy anymore when you're living online.
Well, I think it also becomes a moral issue, because isn't it immoral to treat people like that?
You think morality has anything to do with
this? No, but I do think it does.
No,
I do think it does. And I think this is what we have to give as our sort of bottom line when we think about using these kinds of techniques and technologies, is this morally bankrupt kind of behavior?
Well, and I think because all of this is new, the internet itself is only, 30 years old.
Yeah.
It's relatively new and it's always evolving. We don't quite, as a society, as individuals, understand the implications of what we're doing or how to cope. You know, the whole thing that we've just run through with the latest political processes where the so-called, in quotes, fake news. Okay, well, there are stories out there that are simply not true. Well, we haven't learned yet as a society how to come to grips with the fact that we're constantly bombarded with information and we don't know if it's true or it's not true. You know, we used to believe if Walter Cronkite told us something, it was probably true. We had faith in those institutions. Well, now those institutions are gone and replaced with a cacophony of sound. You know,
here's the thing. As humans, we don't seem to learn anything, because look at the atomic bomb. You know, they said we had no idea our technology would be used like that. Baloney. You know, the first thought that would come to anybody who had a thought would be, man, you could blow up a lot of stuff with that. Sure. And it's the same with this. You know,
every technology that has the ability to make your life better typically also has the ability to make your life worse. And we need to come to terms with what is the right balance.
All right, but we don't have any choice. This is about capitalism and people, a small amount of people making a ton of money. Sure. And I don't see how we influence that. I think it has to come back to our own personal behaviors and saying we're not going to participate.
Yeah, so you have
as much
choices
as possible. We don't have a lot of choices. You started out with that.
Well,
a lot of this pulls us in. We need our phone, and anymore, like, they came and took our landline now, so we don't have a choice. And we also have neighbors who don't even have the ability to use a mobile phone.
Sure. And that's one of the things I wanted to bring up, is we become technology dependent, because a lot of these tools begin to be so ubiquitous that the analog or the reliable backup disappears, and you become totally dependent upon this. A good example was I was teaching a class at a site, off-site, and all of the lighting in the building is controlled by a central computer. There are no light switches in this building. And we were meeting on the weekend, and they couldn't figure out how to get a hold of a person to program the lights so that we had lights in this building when we needed to have lights. Why'd they get rid of the switch? You know, I mean, come on,
This is a common problem in a lot of new schools and things too. They can't figure out how to make the heating and air conditioning work properly.
Well, and the reality is technology breaks down. Technology always breaks down. We have to have some reliable way of walking over and just flipping a switch.
Also, we need human beings to be able to do things simply and not just have somebody one person who knows how to program something.
Yeah, well, and that's another issue. You're leading me into these issues. People become, as this technology becomes ubiquitous, you get more and more disconnected from the world you live in. You know,
well, we're the product. We don't have to think.
Yeah, but I don't know how to turn on the lights. Yeah. I don't know how to turn off the water. What if you walk into a bathroom and the water is running? Well, it's an automatic sensor. I can't turn it off. You know.
Well, there's a water turn off somewhere.
Somewhere.
But most people don't know that today. You do
right.
too, but
no,
you
but,
know. But most people don't
out.
Even know where that is in their own home.
I'm
Where's the shutoff valve?
Yeah, that these things are now outside of our realm of control. And we don't even know how to fix them. We don't know how to work on them. We don't know how to do anything. We don't know how to turn them on and off. They're automated.
Okay, I got one question just to end this.
Just one question.
Is how do we transfer this into or translate this into resiliency as humans?
Well, I guess what you're gonna have to do is, again, make choices and say, all right, if you don't give me the ability to control my world, I will not participate in your product. And yeah, that's going to be inconvenient. I won't be able to get iTunes on my lawnmower, you know? Well, okay, fine.
I never thought of that.
Well, you know, you got to suffer somewhere.
I know, it's pitiful.
So these are issues that we're going to have to deal with, but this is part of our maturing as a society that's interacting with smart things. And once you get into this Internet of Things, now you start beginning to put on top of that artificial intelligence, where these things that are interacting with you and each other are learning as they're interacting. And we already see that, like with predictive software, when you're typing something and it tells you the word.
Oh, I hate autocorrect.
Yeah,
oh,
and you're
God.
Like, I didn't want to say that. I didn't want to say
especially
that.
Especially when they give
that.
You a an anatomically yeah. correct part.
Well, what about if you come home and your door says, no, you don't come home at this time. You must be an intruder. And you go, no, I'm me. I want in my house. No, I'm sorry. I have decided you're not who you say you are. I'm going to keep you from coming into your house. And, you know, that's very, very likely.
But what about the hackers that can control your heart valve or your insulin pump? You know, they're going to extort from you.
Well, there's a lot of
issues.
You. When you're connected, to the cloud, basically you are no longer like, I live in a small town, so the only one who's going to rob my house is somebody who's physically in my town. You know, I'm connected to a worldwide environment of people who want to do me harm.
Yeah, all the time. It's all about money.
Sure. So they can rob me even though I live in a tiny town in Ohio, you know, and they may be in Belarus for all I know.
Yeah.
They were talking in the book I recently read about long distance assassination. You know, if I have a pacemaker in my chest, somebody could hack into that and give like 600 volts directly to my heart, kill me. Be nowhere around, no way of tracing.
Nobody would know.
No, or insulin pumps. I could give a lethal injection. And they showed it, a hacking thing of a guy who demonstrated you could do that to everyone who has this device within a 25-mile radius. Okay, well, you would say, why would anyone do that? Well, why
did they hack into your computer and do stupid things just because they can?
It's a terrorist attack or whatever. Yeah. It's just a way of disrupting your society. And I think the other issue around artificial intelligence, voice and video interaction with these devices is it is just another level of dumbing down human beings.
They don't have too far to go.
Well, that's true, but
we just had an election.
but we no longer have to know how to read. We no longer have to know how to think.
We don't.
No, clearly.
Oh, that'd be terrible.
so
be able to read.
Yeah, I mean, these. If you just say, Alexa, you know, what is the capital of Mongolia? Well, how much did that take? How much research?
You don't know if she's right.
You will accept it, even if she's wrong.
Oh, I'm no good at that. I argue with the GPS woman.
Yeah, but most people will drive. There's been case after case, people driving into the desert because their GPS system told them there was a road there, and they die. So people are very willing to accept whatever's on their screen.
They're sheep, mostly sheep.
Okay, well, leaving it at that, I will say that you have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. Want to thank our producer, Adam Rich, and we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and today you should eat your vegetables.
Yeah, dumb vegetables. Till next time.
Night, I know the stars are dancing in the firelight. Soon we'll be together, I will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing and her children will be healed. Come out, see the morning glory blossom in the night. Know the skies are dancing.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.
This is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
That you are today on this beautiful day. And today we're going to talk about food foraging, or Yul Gibbons would be proud. So
Where do you come up with Yul Gibbons?
Remember Stalking the Wild Asparagus?
I have that book.
Grape Nuts and Johnny Carson. We're aging ourselves here. Anyway, we're not.
They had it at the library, but somebody stole it. So I got it for 50 cents at the library
sale. Yeah, that's what you're claiming anyway.
I didn't steal it. I'm not going to hell over a book.
Okay, so anyway, today we're joined by Laurel Hobden, if she's still here after all of that nonsense. And Laurel is a with Laurel's Blends, and she is a forager, artist, lover of plants, all around good person. So welcome.
Laurel's Blends is her business.
Her business, yes.
She's quite good at it too.
Okay, Laurel. All right, Laurel, welcome. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Jay.
Okie dokie. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Annie and you primarily, and as I said, I'm just going to throw in some snide comments because I know nothing about plants, health. Nothing
that's
about preparing
true.
Food.
that's close.
I can eat food. That's about it. So take it away. All right.
Everything's a weed to Jay. Mm-hmm. But that's a good thing on this talk. Anyway, so Laurel, I think it'd be great if you told us a little bit about your story and how you decided to create Laurel's Blends.
Sure. When I was in my late 20s, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So I went ahead and did the surgery, but I had really strong convictions against chemotherapy. And I had pushed the doctor for the pathologist report, and I only had a 1 in 4 chance of reoccurrence of my cancer. And in talking to the oncologist, if I did chemotherapy, I only had a I had a 1 in 5 chance of reoccurrence. So I thought, for a 5% differential, I'm not going to put myself through chemotherapy. So I got this book by Santillo Humbert called Natural Healing with Herbs. And I decided to go ahead and do burdock root tincture. So I took burdock root tincture for 3 months daily, and I'm here 30 years later, you know, cancer-free, no reoccurrence, and that got me on the herbal path. And I've been on it ever since. I love plants, and I love working with them, and they've got some powerful attributes to share.
What are some of the other things you did? Because this has been a lifelong process of reaching out to have health for yourself, and you've been really healthy, but there are other things that you've done, not just the burdock tincture. What kinds of things do you do as a routine that are beneficial, you feel, to maintaining that health that you have?
Well, first and foremost, you know, I used to, like, when I was a kid, I was the family baker making birthday cakes and all that kind of thing. And then when I became a college student, I became a vegetarian, and I started cooking everything from fresh. I'm no longer vegetarian, but I still do cook everything from fresh. And I think that's one reason I have such good health. And also, I've been swimming laps for 40 years, so that really helps. Now, also, I have a daughter. She is now an adult, and she is autistic. And I have used a variety of essential oils and herbs to help her through her daily life. And that has been helpful to me and to her. And also, I've shared various things with friends. I like to, like, make up different formulas for friends in reference to what's going on with them. And also, I just love playing with food. I'm just one of those kind of people who loves to be in the kitchen experimenting. And so I have done all sorts of things, you know, in the kitchen, as far as, like, fermenting and making, you know, kimchi and kvass and a variety of other things. And also, I like to figure out, like, how many nutrients are in a food, or, like, this food's good for your liver. Like, when I visited China, often when a dish was brought out, they would say, oh, this dish is really good for your yin energy, or this is good for your spleen or your lungs. And I thought, why don't I know those things about my food? I took an herbal class when I was living in the DC area, and she had us working with this book by Paul Pitchford called Healing with Whole Foods. And if you look in that book, it tells you, like, what all the good things that beets are good for, and cabbage. And so I've done a variety of juicing things. I mean, as a cancer survivor, I wanted to maintain my health, and so I tend to do juicing fasts. And I incorporate weeds from my yard in my food, and because they just have such great vibrancy. And so I've worked with food on a lot of different levels, because I like to explore.
Okay, well, let me ask you, Laurel, for those of us who are completely disconnected from the world, what is a juicing fast? You say a juicing fast, like I should know what that is.
Oh, sure. Okay, well, a juicing fast is basically you're making fresh juices from fruits and vegetables, and you are drinking them, and that is basically your diet for 1 to 2 weeks, depending on what you're planning on cleansing. And you can also, like, you can, different juices are good for different parts of your body, like the beets are really great for your liver, and so that's what I would do. I would do, like, depending on what kind of fast I was doing, like, there's intestinal fast, there's, like, liver fast, these various cleanses. And so I would tailor the juicing I was doing in reference to those things. And also in these, like, I love working this one book. It's called Healing with Juices. And it gives you protocols for doing these various fasts. And I've worked with that. And one of the things I like to do every spring is, for at least a month, I take dandelion root tincture. And it's well known as a liver tonic. and thus being that it supports your liver and running optimally. And your liver has over 500 functions, one of them being filtering 6 cups of blood a minute, plus also dandelion root tincture ups my digestive juices, so I'm getting more nutrients out of my food. And so I consider it a longevity medicinal herb because it has these great qualities. So that I do that every spring as part of my anti-cancer routine.
I remember one time I heard you say in a talk that in the fall or in the summer you should mark your hardiest, biggest, most robust dandelions so you could dig up the root.
Yeah, and my grandmother's.
Yes, that's right. So what would you be exposed to or feel that would prompt you to think that you needed to have a week-long juice fast?
Well, unfortunately, just breathing the air, there's toxins in the air. I mean, you know, burning coal puts mercury in the air. And so even if you're just breathing the air, you know, even if you're living a very healthy life by drinking filtered water and eating organic food, it is good to cleanse your system. And a lot of people, I mean, like here in the USA, we have a very refined diet generally. And that stuff can build up on the walls of your intestines, and so it makes it so you're not absorbing your nutrients as well as you could, and plus there could be some putrefaction. So it's good to kind of like move that stuff through, and the more fiber and stuff you're eating, the more you're kind of like roto-rootering your intestines, so you don't get a buildup, and also you're not like absorbing food. I mean, people can have like a you know, like a very thick coating on their intestinal walls that blocks their absorption, and also some of their absorption, and also it's going bad in there. So it's good not to be exposed to that or minimize that.
I know one time I went to see this guy. I was like so sick and I just could hardly go, and it wasn't the flu, it was my body being in toxic overload, and he showed me all the chemicals that were in my bowel, and I was thinking back when I was in high school working, making copies, so I had a lot of copy toner in my bowel. I was like, oh my God. Anyway, he helped me a lot, but it wasn't from roto-rootering, I don't think.
I kept telling you, don't eat the toner.
There's chemicals in a lot of things. We are exposed to a lot more chemicals than our forefathers were. I mean, how many people know that there is fire retardant in breast milk because it's you absorb things from your clothes?
I heard plastic threads
everywhere.
Well, getting off of bowels here for a second.
Well, wait, before we do that, I just want to explain the word refined, because it's not refine, it's refined. And you're by that, I think you mean like things like white sugar, white flour, that type of foods. These are the base of our diet in this culture, right?
That's right. Yes. The thing is when you have refined foods, a lot of the nutrients are stripped away. I mean, they do enrich flour, but it's not like eating whole wheat flour or something like that, which hasn't had its nutrients taken away. And also the fiber, it also supports health in your system too.
Okay. Well, I was going to get you off onto the foraging part because I kind of... introduce that. So when you're talking, you've already mentioned about dandelions. What other things that commonly people might run across, maybe not even realizing that they're edible, and not only edible but good for you?
Well, maybe violets. We should talk about what foraging is first.
Yeah, okay, wander around.
No, go not for it. Exactly.
Go for it. Wander around chewing on things, benches.
See somebody's like yard and you go, man, you have the best weeds, and just start picking them. You're going to get shot.
Yeah. And just be careful when you go to your neighbors. Don't say, hey, you got any weed? So that could get you into a whole different world of foraging.
What kind of weeds do you have?
All right, go for it.
Well, there are lots of things that I like to forage in my yard. I'm super excited. My red bud is about ready to bloom, and I'll be eating the flowers off my red bud. And so one thing that I think is great to get into your diet are violet leaves. And I have this book that I absolutely love by Susan Weed. It's called Healing Wise, and it has seven chapters. Each chapter is devoted to a quote unquote weed, and it tells like its nutrient qualities, its medicinal qualities, and gives you recipes. And one of the plants that she discusses in this book are violets. Well, violets in the past have been used for breast cancer as a specific. And so one of the things I like to do in the summertime is peruse my yard and see what's growing that is edible, and gather those and make myself a drink. So I might be gathering purslane, violet, wood sorrel, violet leaves, lamb's quarters, wild grape leaves. So I just get a handful of those things. I put them in my blender with some fruit, some water, maybe some bee pollen, start off minimally at first. And I blend that all together with some sunflower or pumpkin seeds, and that's a green smoothie. And I'm getting lots and lots of chlorophyll. And by incorporating these fresh green plants into my body, Paul Pitchford, who wrote Healing with Whole Foods, which is like a 700-page plus tome of awareness about food, you're getting this chlorophyll, and chlorophyll it's detoxing, it's anti-inflammatory, and it renews and builds your blood. And one thing that many people probably don't know about chlorophyll is that it almost is molecularly similar. It is molecularly similar to blood. The only difference is that the central molecule in chlorophyll is magnesium, and the central molecule in blood is iron. So that's the only differential. So the thing is if you're eating your chlorophyll, it makes sense that it would be renewing your blood. And so the things I say is eat your weeds and chocolate, because chocolate has your iron, and then if you're getting your chlorophyll, you know, then you are rebuilding your body, and your blood is what feeds your body. You know, I mean, good circulation, and you want to have nutrients in your blood to feed your body. I mean, that's why being sedentary is so bad for your body, because you're not getting that blood deep into your tissues through movement. And you certainly want to feed your body. I mean, that's really critical for health, is eating health, you know, eating healthy.
Okay, well, Laura, let me interrupt you here for just a second to let people know that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
Thank God.
So we're joined today by Laurel Hobden, all around good guy and feeder of blood. Feeder of blood.
She got your attention when she said eat chocolate.
Yeah, eat chocolate. It was reminding. Okay, well, I'm good about one out of those two things. So
one out of one.
One.
Well,
out
let
of
me
two.
Let me just say that it's really early spring right now, so there's a lot of food, and in fact, violets are starting to bloom, which is unbelievable. But there's a lot of wild lettuce and even lemon balm, which makes lovely tea. There are a lot of really great plants out there. And I thought it would be fun if we talked about what are some things that, some ways that you might make salad. Like somebody may think, well, the green smoothie doesn't sound so great. But I know this weekend we picked a lot of greens out of the high tunnel, but then we went around and gathered up dead nettle, purple dead nettle, and some wild lettuce, and lots of wild garlic and chives to add to our salad mix. So I was thinking it might be good if we talked a little bit about, you know, what you think would make a good salad in the summertime or now.
Sure. Well, right now, something that is about ready to bloom in the Midwest is the red bud. And These flowers, you just taste the high vitamin C of them, and they're nice sprinkled over the top as kind of like a crouton, a crouton or something like that at the top. Not that they're crunchy, but they are very flavorful. But there's lots of things you can gather in your yard. I mean, dandelion leaves and the cleavers and purslane. I mean, purslane apparently is very high in the omega-3s. So certainly a good thing to get into your diet. And I like to use the wild grape leaves and chickweed. Chickweed is wonderful. I mean, it just has this light salty taste, and it has lots of benefits for your body. I mean, certainly check out Susan Weed's book, Healing Wise. And
don't taste great after they get to be a certain size.
Right, they are better in the spring
when they're young. The other thing I'll say about redbud is that you'd want to be really careful right now with redbud, not to pick too many of the blooms. They do set seed pods, like pea pods that people buy to saute, and you can use them the same way in stir fry. But they're being really bombarded by climate change, and they're not producing as many buds. And actually, there's a study that's gathered a lot of us in and asked us to do some measuring and observation on the red buds that we have, and we do have quite a few here at Blue Rock Station. But they are delicious. Just keep in mind you should leave some buds, maybe pods to eat, but also just because you want to have some seed, we may need it.
Certainly, yeah. Well, whenever foraging, you shouldn't take more than 10% of what is available, just to assure that there will continue to be availability, that it'll still be growing and be healthful.
Uh-huh. Are there other rules around foraging?
Well, certainly, you want to have 100% identification. You certainly want to know exactly what you're eating, because there are some poisonous lookalikes. Many foraging books, they tell you exactly how to identify to make sure that the plant is what you are looking for. And you certainly want to be solid about that. You don't want to eat Queen Anne's lace looks very similar to water hemlock, which is poisonous. So you certainly want to make sure you're not getting water hemlock when you are looking for Queen Anne's lace, which is sometimes referred to as a wild carrot.
You know, one time, a long time ago, one of our interns wanted to make stinging nettle soup because he was going back to work in a restaurant and they were going to have that as a recipe. And so we went out and gathered what we thought was the stinging nettle, and we made some soup, and he took a big spoonful of it, and he turned green, I swear, and he goes, "Here, try it." And I said, "Well, listen, first of all, when you try something, you don't take a big bite, you take a little bite." And it turned out it was motherwort, and boy, did it taste
Oh, my
bad.
Gosh. Oh, yeah, motherwort
really
is really bitter. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It would, if you weren't sick and you needed to be, or you wanted to be sick, it'd be the cure.
Well, Laurel, before we run out of time, I wanted to touch on some of the medicinal aspects, but I also wanted to touch, because we'd had some conversations before, how the medical model establishment can sort of be pretty harsh on folks who claim that plants have actual medicinal values. You know, it's strange where we hear these things like thinking of taking a walk, ask your doctor. Well, it's like thinking of eating something, you know,
ask your doctor.
Yeah, don't ask your doctor. They know nothing about this stuff.
They get like on average one class one semester on nutrition.
But I know you've got to, when you're talking about these things are good for you, they're healthy and all that, you got to kind of tiptoe around the word
medicinal
legal disclaimer. So how what's your reaction to that, or are you going to just remain silent so you don't hear from the lawyers?
No, I think it's good to speak from personal experience and also cite other like authors of books and the research that's out there presently, and take it from that level. Yeah, because unfortunately people who are working with medicinal herbs are having to put up with the pressure of the government and not being, you know, talking about the medicinal qualities of plants. Like one of our recent local herbalists is no longer publishing articles because she got a letter from the FDA in reference to her sharing some information about dealing with the pandemic, which is unfortunate because that is shutting down a good resource that could be helpful to many.
Well, one of the challenges too is that, first of all, they're hypocrites in that, well, many ways probably, but there are many major medications that people use that have these long names, but within them are medicinal plants.
Like aspirin, you know?
Yeah, well, they've added stuff to it, but it's nothing more than willow bark juice that's been dried.
Well, unfortunately, what they do is they find what they consider the active ingredient, and then they concentrate it, or they might create it chemically, you know, as opposed mm-hmm. to getting it from the source. And generally, when you use a plant in its full, you know, it's the whole part of the plant, then it buffers those kind of things. And that kind of thing is not taken into consideration, you know, in the Western medical approach.
Right. Well, so in terms of medicinals, one of the things that I have thought for many years is funny is, you know, eucalyptus is a very powerful, important plant. And so I think at our house, we've come full circle because we were kids and we were totally icked out by Vicks Vapor Rub, which is petroleum jelly, which probably is not a great thing, but with eucalyptus in it. And, you know, we used to have to wear that when we got sick and have it rubbed on our chest and stuff. Or
the vaporizer.
Yeah. And really, that was, our moms didn't know why that worked. But today we know, you know, eucalyptus is just a really powerful plant for helping with congestion and, you know, all the things that go along with being really sick. So I thought maybe we could talk about some plants that you like in particular, or if you want to mention something, and I don't have any problem talking about it either, since I'm not in business of blending herbs, but I do spend a lot of time with people, especially with our interns when they first come. You know, they're almost always sick, particularly with like acne, and so we start out with a really high dose of acidophilus, which you can get acidophilus by eating plain yogurt, but it's not powerful enough. And within a week, they're in shock at how much better their skin is and actually how much better they feel. So things like
that's
that.
Wonderful.
You know, acidophilus is a bacteria. It's not a plant, but still, it's an example of how you correct one little thing instead of pouring more drugs into it.
Right. Well, one thing in particular that I always have in my refrigerator is garlic-infused organic olive oil. And I personally use that for earaches and toothaches. I was chasing my son around the house. He loved it. He was little. And I could feel my heartbeat in my tooth. My toothache was so bad. And so that night before I went to bed, I took a cotton ball and I put some of my garlic oil on that. And I put it between my molars in the back where that was going on, and the next day I could take those molars and I can grind them, and there was no pain whatsoever. And when I saw the dentist later that day, she said, well, if that happens again, we're talking root canal. And I wish I had kept up with the garlic oil, because about 3 years later I did end up having a root canal with that tooth. And so I always have garlic oil, you know, in my refrigerator to help me out with that kind of thing. Yeah. And one thing I found helpful for me was when I had the flu, when you had the aches and pains of flu, just one drop of peppermint essential oil under the tongue, and you might want to have somebody to chase it because it's very strong, but that takes away the aches and pains of the flu. And when I had the flu several years back, I would take a drop as soon as the aches and pains returned. And after doing that for 48 hours, the flu was all gone. And my partner of the time had that flu for a week, where I was over it in 48 hours. And I think that peppermint helped out there.
Yeah.
You know, also, well, I do grow.
Great.
Yeah. I also do.
With goats, too. You know, this isn't just humans. We use peppermint with goats. The garlic oil we keep in the milk room, so when we need it for any number of things with goats. And it's always great because, you know, it's something you could take for yourself, so you're not pushing anything onto them that's not natural.
Okay, well, Laurel, I'm going to have to draw this conversation to a close. So you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our guest, Laurel Hobden. Well, thank you, Laurel. And we want to thank
you.
Our Emmy award-winning, always eating and foraging, Adam Rich, our producer. And we want to thank you
Adam,
for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is?
You should go to Laurel's workshop. She's having one in May.
Is that all she said?
That's what she said.
All right. Okay, till next time. Bye-bye.
Blossom in the night. Know the skies are dancing in the firelight. Soon we'll be together. I will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and the children will be healed.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.